You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, was the 5-second rule part of your childhood? Is it maybe part of your adulthood too? We learn whether or not it's safe to eat food that has fallen on the floor, no matter the amount of time it's spent there, from a food safety professor. First, a new study finds that Wisconsin is one of the top 3 states when it comes to drone use by public safety agencies. Places like your local law enforcement or fire departments may be using the technology for what they say are better strategies at keeping the public safe. But some civil rights activists and advocates are pushing back and arguing we need better regulation to protect citizens' privacy. Danielle Kading is a reporter for WPR based in Superior. She wrote about the new research and she joins us from our Superior studios. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So break it down for us. What exactly did this study find?
So this study found that the number of police, fire, and sheriff's departments in the state using these drones tripled from 18 to 56 in Wisconsin this year. And across the country, that more than doubled to 910. So part of that is due because the Federal Aviation Administration recently put in place requirements or rules as far that would guide how these drones are used. So that, I think that's one reason that's driving the use. But also here in Wisconsin, the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College, who did this report, said that they thought maybe Wisconsin is seeing growth because it's less expensive than using manned aircraft. So maybe agencies that couldn't afford, you know, an airplane or a helicopter or something like that would have the budget for a drone.
It still seems interesting that Wisconsin would be one of the top 3, the other 2 being California and Texas. If cost is a factor, and I guess I'm making an assumption, but I'm guessing that other states' law enforcement and fire departments are not necessarily, you know, flush with cash and don't know what to do with it. Why would that be more of a factor here in Wisconsin than elsewhere?
You know, it's really hard to say because the study didn't really look into why that is. It just looked into the numbers as to where they're seeing this growth. Out in California and Texas, they see more use of manned aircraft. So I guess maybe it makes sense for them to also look at using drones. Here in the Midwest, we don't really see that much manned aircraft or airplanes used. So it makes more sense money-wise for them to look at drones.
So we're looking at police departments, sheriff's departments, fire departments using these drones. Can you give us some specific examples, Danny, about how they're using them and in what situations?
Sure. So recently, a month ago, when a series of explosions and fires broke out at the Husky Energy Oil Refinery in Superior, the Superior Police Department used its drone along with Husky officials to get a better look at the blaze that broke out there. And the Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander said that they were able to get in there and get a view of what was going on with that fire so that they could see a path to start defensive firefighting operations. For him, he said it's not known whether that would have affected the outcome, but it certainly would have delayed it.
And what about on law enforcement side? What are some of the uses that they're putting drones into place for?
Well, for some other reasons that law enforcement use it, like in Rock County, they're looking to use these drones to help with missing persons. They have, I think, what's called silver alerts, where any elderly people go missing, then they're out trying to look for them, and that takes valuable time and resources. So this helps them to save that time and be able to find people quickly in a search and rescue situation. There, they've also used it to assess damage from storms or natural disasters in rural areas where the terrain can be difficult or maybe flood. Or some sort of event could have prevented access from the road. And then also agencies are using them in tactical situations like SWAT teams using them or searches of buildings, you know, where there may be a threat to officers. And if they can avoid that, they'll send a drone in instead to protect people in that situation.
We're talking with Danielle Kading. She's a WPR reporter in Superior, and she's with us to talk about a new study that found Wisconsin is one of the top 3 states for use of drones by public safety agencies. And Danny, there have been concerns and criticisms raised, those focus a lot around privacy. What are some of the concerns that people have with drones?
Well, some of the concerns related to privacy is that, you know, people may not be following rules or regulations related to their use. And the development of rules or laws surrounding this emerging technology is still being created. In Wisconsin, a law took effect in 2014 that under state law, agencies, law enforcement, had to obtain a search warrant to gather evidence with a drone if people have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Hmm. And so there's still some development, too, on a local level as far as policies go. Some cities or towns may be considering ordinances to control their use. Generally, you can't use drones within 5 miles of an airport. And there have been a number of interesting state laws that have come up related to drone use. Like, you can't use them in state prisons because that could net you a $5,000 fine. You can't use them to track hunters as part of Wisconsin's hunter harassment bill. And it's just, a lot of things are still changing with that, and the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin is concerned about this technology. They think that it can be useful, but basically that we need to be forward-thinking and try and create some open-ended policies to guide how they're being used in order to protect privacy and protect civil rights and civil liberties.
And you did speak, Danny, with Emilio De Torre from the American Civil Liberties Union. Let's hear what he had to say.
I'm worried that it's just going to be a new toy that's going to be used willy-nilly, and one or two high-profile good examples will be elevated, and there's a great opportunity for wholesale abuse of privacy and civil rights and civil liberties of the citizens of Wisconsin.
And so what kind of regulations or oversight would the American Civil Liberties Union like to see? And I guess it's kind of, they're different sides of the same coin. There's the use of drones by individuals, and then there's the use of drones by government agencies.
Yeah, so that was Emilio De Torre, and as he said, he wants to encourage communities to be proactive, basically develop an open-ended policy that requires agencies to account for the technology that they're buying, whether it's a drone or something else. Like, I mean, we're seeing a lot of attention being paid to cell phones right now and apps and law enforcement's activity to try and unlock data, whether it's related to domestic terrorism or other incidents. So they're saying that they would like to see open-ended policies on technology that they can buy, its usage, how they store data. He also noted that the use of drones should be subject to regular monitoring. You know, maybe have like a quarterly or twice a year check just to see that that technology isn't being used in a manner that undermines people's civil liberties.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know about drone technology myself, and I don't know if this is something that came up, but the images that the drones are collecting, are those actually saved or are they just live? Because it would seem it would be hard to monitor how they're being used if there's not a record.
Well, that's part of the question, and each department can develop its own policy, you know, within the confines of state law. So, like, the Mass and Police Department, for example, has, you know, standard operating procedures that is publicly available on their website that guides, you know, things like storage and also under what circumstances they can use drones to gather evidence. As far as hobbyists are concerned under state law, you know, if they decide they want to be a peeping Tom with this technology, they can be charged with a misdemeanor. So it's something that's still evolving, and people are trying to think of different ways in which to deal with this technology in the best way that combines, you know, the benefits of its use while also protecting people's privacy.
And as we start to wrap up, Danny, have you heard from members of law enforcement agencies that are using the drones about whether they think these concerns raised by the ACLU and some citizens, whether they're valid?
Well, Madison's Police Lieutenant Mike Hansen, who leads a team of 11 officers who are trained and certified to operate these drones, he said that he hasn't received any complaints and that that would have come to him. And so though the ACLU is making this argument that, well, people may not be making complaints because they don't even know that police departments or law enforcement are using it. And so there should be openness and transparency about what technology departments and agencies are using so that local governments know, so that residents know, and steps can be taken to ensure the best use of that technology.
Well, Danny, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
That was Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter based in Superior. She was with us to talk about a new study that found Wisconsin was one of three states with the highest use of drones by public safety agencies. Now, we've probably all been in this situation, whether it's a really special piece of cake or just some potato chips. What do you do when you accidentally drop a piece on the floor? Some people might pick it up quickly and apply the trusty 5-second rule. Others might make the call based on the stickiness of the particular food or, let's face it, how much you really want to eat it. But do any of those factors really make a difference? Paul Dawson is a professor and the graduate coordinator of the Food Safety and Nutrition Program team at Clemson University in South Carolina, and he's researched the 5-second rule. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So you teach food safety and nutrition. Tell us honestly, how often do your students ask about the 5-second rule?
Well, I get asked a lot about it now since I published a paper a few years ago. And more times than not, people, not my students, but general public, around here anyway, you kind of know, have a local, locally known for that. So I get that question a lot.
So did you grow up in a household that went with the 5-second rule?
Gosh, I'm not sure. I would think if everyone was asked, they might have to confess that at some point in their life, if they live long enough, they probably tried to use the 5-second rule. I'm sure I have.
I will confess on public radio airwaves that I have definitely picked something up that I just couldn't bear the thought of tossing out. So where do we get this idea of 5 seconds? It seems so arbitrary.
Yeah, the actual origin of that really is difficult to follow. We did a little background work, and it really we found some information from Genghis Khan, but it really wasn't a 5-second rule. I think he had a rule because he had a belief that if food was produced for him, it was worthy of eating no matter how long it stayed on the floor. So,
wow.
And then there was some folklore about Julia Child's dropping something on while she was on television, and it was a turkey or whatever. She's made some comment, but it actually was found out to be a pancake, and kind of said if you put it back in the pan, it'd be okay. So I'm not really sure where it came from. The first mention of it that we found in our work was a study done, not published, but reported on in 2003 at the University of Illinois, and did a study where, again, they dropped food on different surfaces and reported that it didn't pick up bacteria pretty quickly. And then there's been numerous television shows and podcasts that have done similar things. Mythbusters did a piece on it and so forth. So not real sure where it started. I think it just kind of emerged from the folklore.
So is there a difference between what kind of food it is and how safe it might be to scoop up quickly and eat?
Well, that's studies, Judith. We do a statistical analysis, and there's really two published studies. That one is ours, and one is done out of Rutgers by Dr. Schaffner and Miranda, a grad student. And actually, when you run the data on that, there is a difference due to food and actually how long it stays on the surface. Obviously, you might think in common sense would tell you a wet food, damp food would pick up more than a dry food, which is the case. But in looking at it from you look at the statistical results, and then look at it from a practical standpoint, like we should, not just look at the numbers, that there is enough bacteria picked up by any food almost instantaneously that if it's something there that'll make you sick, it's going to be on the food.
And so what kind of bacteria are we possibly picking up? Because I have to say it's fairly common to see on social media and stuff like, there's more bacteria on your cell phone than there is in the bathroom or whatever. It seems like, I'm surprised that we're not all coming down with food poisoning all the time.
Yeah, well, that's the good news is that, as you've probably heard before, most bacteria are harmless, and a lot of them are actually helpful. I think less than 1% are harmful. So it really would depend on where you drop the food, whether it made you sick or not. Some of the common things we'd be concerned about is if you have a raw food and you're making a salad or your sandwich or whatever, and you've had that raw food in on a surface, and you go, someone goes after you, haven't cleaned it up, and you drop, say, bread on there, and it picks up some contamination, for instance, from salmonella, chicken from salmonella or whatever. Of course, if you're in a highly contaminated area like a hospital, then I think the odds would be pretty high. So it really depends on the surface, and the location is not really the time or the other food so much. So I think, again, most of the time you could probably, it's more of a yuck factor in most cases.
I was just thinking that this was a pretty high yuck factor segment that we're doing. Actually, though, Paul, what about the difference of the surface it's falling on? So, you know, thinking of a kitchen floor, maybe it's tile, maybe it's wood, ours is cork at home, maybe carpet. Does it matter what kind of surface it is, how accessible the bacteria is?
Well, that's we actually, both our studies did that. We did a tile, a wood floor, and a carpet, actually. And oddly enough, I guess, again, as you think about it, I might expect this, we inoculated the surfaces, of course, and then dropped the food on there. And actually, the carpet transferred less bacteria than the other two. And common sense, again, you think about it a little bit, common sense that the bacteria would kind of penetrate the carpet and then drop the food on top of the carpet, it's not going to have as much surface area. I think the other side of that would be, you know, most carpet sits around a long time and probably gets damp and is inoculated over and over again. So there's probably a lot more bacteria residing in the average carpet. But again, as far as getting in contact with that, maybe the, in our study anyway, it's a very controlled study, the carpet was better. But again, I wouldn't recommend that in any case.
Well, so, Paul, as we start to wrap up here, I have to ask, is it or is it not okay to eat food that has fallen on the floor?
The analogy I use is like wearing a seatbelt. You could probably drive your car your whole life and never have an accident and don't wear a seatbelt. It's not going to, you know, not going to affect you. But like if you have an accident, be like if there is, happens to be a bacteria there that's harmful, then you're going to pick it up. But again, the odds are very low, but you're kind of playing Russian roulette to a certain extent.
All right. So with driving and eating, safety first.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's what I would say.
All right. Well, Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Judith.
Paul Dawson is a professor and the graduate coordinator of the Food Safety and Nutrition Program Team at Clemson University in South Carolina. With over 52,000 self-storage facilities in the U.S., this country is home to 90% of the self-storage industry found in the world. You may have noticed more and more mini garage-type spaces popping up near you. They've hit rural Wisconsin and the largest cities, leaving us to wonder, do we have too much stuff? Nancy Wong is chair and a professor of consumer science in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you, Judy.
So this is really an interesting topic to me. I've definitely noticed that I see them so much more in the U.S. than in other countries. And with so much of the self-storage industry in the United States, with your background in consumer behavior and consumption habits, are you surprised that that's the case?
Well, actually, to be honest, not at all. I think it is a combination of our habits as well as I think what has been happening in the general economic environment that this country is facing.
And when did self-storage units for consumers, for average people, first start being available?
Well, I think it has actually been around for a while, but then, I don't know the exact time when it came into, you know, popular use. But I do believe that there is always a continuous need for something like that as we go through life transitions.
Mm-hmm. And there's life transitions, and then there's also just wanting to hold on to stuff, and we'll talk about that more. But as someone who studies consumer behavior and consumption, when did you first start kind of zeroing in on the concept of self-storage?
Well, I think it has to do with, you know, my interest in, I think, materialism and how people form attachments to their possessions.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those attachments that we feel to things?
Well, I guess you know, humans are very, I think it is important to us to sort of like define and understand our world through consumption, because we need to consume in order to survive, first of all. And but as, you know, we become a more industrialized and sophisticated culture, we get to own more and more things and consume more and more things. And it comes to actually become a very central part of our sort of meaning and well-being in life. And perhaps in this country more so than almost anywhere else.
So what are some of the common reasons that people are taking that step of not just saving things, but actually renting additional space outside of their homes to store things?
Well, I think it's because of, again, I think it is such an important part of our life that, you know, I guess most people don't think about the fact that things are not just things once we own them. They actually occupy a special place, and it has special meaning for us. I think from the perspective of my studies, we think about how our possessions actually establish our identity, how we are distinctive from others. It provides us with a sense of security and give us a sense of our own history and a sense of continuity. And, you know, how it defines our relationships and a sense of belonging to others. And, you know, how we actually take pride and, you know, in our possessions, and also how it makes us become more effective in our daily lives, whether we become a better cook because of the latest gadget that we have, or, you know, how we actually communicate how important someone is by making something special for them, like knitting that special Christmas sweater. So I think it means so much to, you know, us in terms of possessions. It's never just one simple thing. So the fact that it has such deep meaning, it also means that it is impossible to let go.
We're talking with Nancy Wong. She's chair and a professor in the Consumer Science Department in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. And we're talking about the tremendous rise in the self-storage industry and why we save things and what we're putting in those units. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you rent a storage unit? What led to that? Was it a downsizing move, maybe divorce, lifestyle change that made you consider getting one? And do you see it as a long-term or a short-term solution for having more stuff than you have room for? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Nancy, you study consumerism and consumption. Are there particular groups of people that you see as being more likely to be savers of stuff than others?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there are actually any number of psychological and behavioral scales that researchers often use to actually measure these sort of individual level differences. And you know, I guess you can think about it from occupying the entire spectrum of people who form normal attachments, like the average person is a rare individual that doesn't actually have an attachment to things. But, you know, of course, I think you can go to the other extreme spectrum to the, you know, what people would call hoarding behavior. So that actually is probably taking this very natural tendencies that we have to the extreme, and that could happen.
I read a bunch of different articles in preparing for this segment, and a lot of the people that the different journalists talked about saving these things that were from their children's growing up period, you know, report cards and pictures, but also from people's own childhoods from, you know, maybe 40, 50, 60 or more years ago. And many of the people expressed this sense of wanting to be able to pass things on to their children, grandchildren. But there seems to be, in recent generations, kind of, I don't want to say rejection in a bad way, but they are trying to live more minimalistic lives. So it seems like there's a real cultural clash happening right now.
There is. And I think some of it is also due to economic necessities, because I've also just remember reading about the fact that home ownership rates is in the 30 years low among the millennials. So we are much less likely to own our own homes. And if we do actually live in a rental space, chances are they are going to be smaller. So all of that actually compels us towards living in a much more minimalistic way. So you're right. I think it is an upcoming potential cultural clash here.
And let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Mike in Sun Prairie is up. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just in the middle of rooting out my double car garage here, and I've been threatening to nail the Christmas supplies for the last 2 or 3 years, and I'm finally doing it today. There are like 13 totes full of Christmas supplies. And I said, we've got to do something. So I've started doing it today.
Wow.
And I got the feeling I'm going to get chewed pretty good when the headquarters people come home.
We'll just guess who the headquarters people are, Mike. But what, you know, what was kind of that switch being flipped for you that you went from having this stuff to saying, you know, we've got to pare down here?
Because it's getting to the point where I can't get the vehicles in the garage. I can't get the rest of the stuff in the garage. And you know, it's funny because her mother grew up in a place that was devastated by wars, and her mom just they essentially lost everything. So I think that might be part of it with the whole bunch, too. So who knows?
That's really interesting, Mike. And Nancy, I know that there's often been reference to people who grew up during the Depression, that they have a really hard time letting go of something because they can't shake that feeling that I might need this someday.
Yes. And also, it's giving up a part of your personal history as well. If that thing is gone, I mean, I guess a lot of the times we tend to attach all these. They serve as memories for an experience that we have gone through, and getting rid of it means that there is no trace of it anymore. So I think that really becomes a very difficult part of letting go. It's really hanging on to that memory.
Thanks for that call, Mike. We're talking with Nancy Wong. She is in the Consumer Science Department in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. We're talking about the rise in self-storage facilities and why there's such a demand to store our stuff. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a storage unit? What led to you renting one? And if you have a storage unit, or maybe you've managed to break the habit, tell us the process that you went through. Have you seen more self-storage units popping up in your area? And if, like our last caller, you just feel like you have too much stuff, what's your plan for paring down? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. We're continuing our discussion with Nancy Wong, chair and professor in the Consumer Science Department in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about renting extra storage space? Is it an option you've considered or maybe taken advantage of? Do you feel like as Americans, we have a tendency to hold on to things too long? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Nancy, the average monthly cost of a storage unit is about $90, which isn't cheap. Do we know if this is a move that people are making, thinking that it's going to be short term, just in a transition, or are they planning on this long term because they really don't want to have to deal with getting rid of those items?
I would honestly say that when most people started out, they thought of it as a temporary solution to either something that you know, as they go through life's transition. And sometimes I think it ended up taking longer than they expected, as in moving into a house that they have intended to move into. Or, you know, something else happened along the way, and it upsets their plan of, you know, moving into that particular transition. So I think it was probably meant to be a temporary solution that just take on a life of its own.
Let's go back to the phones, and Brian in Madison is up. Hi, Brian.
Hey, hi.
Hi.
My wife and I definitely fit into that category where we had expected to move into a house, and rented a smaller apartment and started a house search, and in the market simply were not able to find something that we could afford, and so have had a storage unit now for quite a bit longer than we thought we would.
So initially you thought you would put some stuff in storage just until you had a house, and now you're finding a house that's affordable or one that fits your needs isn't happening. So how, at what point, Brian, would you say, you know, maybe we need to get rid of some stuff, or are you just going to keep it in there kind of as long as it needs to be?
Well, the interesting thing is we really did get rid of a lot of stuff. We don't have a lot of things in that storage unit that I would consider to be extraneous or, you know, memories that we just can't part with. It's really pared down to, about 800 square feet worth of possessions and a couple canoes. So I don't feel like we're holding on to things because we can't part with them. We have a fairly minimal set of possessions that we can't find a place for, and we don't want to have to replace them all if hopefully when we do find that place.
All right.
But I could see how somebody in that situation would end up with a long-term storage unit and not able to find the right space.
Thanks for that call, Brian, at 800-642-1234. Let's go next to Lester in Madison. Hi, Lester.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So my comment is, my parents grew up in the Depression, and I basically did a lot of my adult growing up as a hippie living on a commune in the country. And I have a lot of stuff.
And what kind of stuff is it, Lester?
I have all kinds of stuff. I have lumber. I have tools. I have books. I had vinyl records. I still have some. But I guess the point I want to make is I found myself going back to the storage unit to bring things back home because I needed them. I think that the idea of holding on to things that might be useful isn't such a bad idea. We have such a throwaway society. People don't fix things anymore. That's one thing that I try to do. Sometimes I have something that I haven't figured out how to fix yet, but I will.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Lester. And Nancy, Lester's call kind of made me think about the fact that it seems like there are a few different themes to why people save things. And one of them, like Lester said, was he doesn't know when he's going to need these things, so he doesn't want to get rid of it and have to replace it. I think there's also, and I will say it's on a much smaller scale, more like a couple drawers than a storage unit, but there'll be a project that I think I'm going to take on sometime. I think, I don't want to get rid of that because I'd really like to do that project. And it seems like it's this idea that at some unknown point in the future, these things are going to be needed or wanted, and we're trying to avoid that moment where we think, I just wish I hadn't gotten rid of that.
Yes, I completely agree with you in the sense that I think that is also a very natural instinct, and I completely agree with the fact that we are becoming too much of a throwaway society. So there is actually that push and pull between these two. So, and there is also the other culture that has emerged that kind of speaks to some of this in the sense that, you should just rent something that you are going to use for a short period of time, like rent a runway, beg, borrow, and steal, whatever the case may be, as opposed to having to own something or using a car service as opposed to owning a car. So they are actually also increasingly more market solutions that actually try to reduce ownership of things. So here's a whole other culture again.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And another contrast that I thought of when I was reading up on this topic is that a lot of the newer storage unit facilities are not being built from the ground up for that purpose. They're actually repurposing things like former malls. And the idea that a place that used to be where people bought stuff is now where people put the stuff that they've bought just kind of blows my mind.
Yes, it does. It is really fascinating. I think that's why I've become so fascinated with this subject, because there's so much complex, I think, emotions and motivations and psychologies behind it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones, and Tyler in Madison is up. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. What did you have to say?
Oh, well, that's tough to follow up everything right there. One question I had, though, is even though this is seems to be like something that people want, more storage, how come it's still so expensive?
So why, if there's such a demand, why isn't it driving, or if why isn't the availability of it driving down the price?
Yes.
All right. And Nancy, do we know what kind of directs the availability and cost of this kind of service? Because it seems like for the people who are renting out the space, they have really minimal overhead.
That's true. But then at the same time, I guess, you know, I think our prices are really determined by supply and demand. So unfortunately, if the demand is keeping up as what we expect that it is, seems to be going, I don't see prices coming down anytime soon.
And Tyler, have you used a storage facility yourself?
No, I have not. I am actually planning on two, though.
Oh, and what's the motivation for you to rent one?
My motivation is because Madison has been kind of a home base for me. I've lived here my entire life, and now I'm going backpacking, and I need, like, you know, to keep my couch and my bed here safe.
So for you, it's actually replacing your residence. It's not in addition to your residence.
No, it is not. It is replacing my residency here.
Really interesting. And so, Nancy, that's one that we haven't really talked about. I mean, we've talked about, you know, people using it in addition to where they're living. But for some people who are making a big life change like Tyler, you know, it can give you that freedom to say, I'm leaving the life I'm living right now, but I don't want to totally close the door on it either.
That's true, but it still qualifies as life transition. So I guess if we keep it general enough, it still fits in that category. But it is interesting, though. How long does Tyler intend to go camping or, you know, traveling around the world? So it could go from a very temporary solution to a long-term solution.
You never know. Tyler might end up living wherever he lands. Thanks for that call, Tyler. And let's go next to Karen in Rice Lake. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. Very interesting conversation. Often some of the people that I've worked with are using it not because of an unwanted transition. They are homeless, not moving from place to place, but simply have no place, cannot afford a place. And so that becomes the only place left to store anything that matters.
Mm.
And not even saying that they're not living there from time to time. But it is not a wanted transition. It is sometimes a necessity. Mm.
And we're running a little short on time, Karen, so I want to give Nancy a chance to respond. So for some reason, for some people, rather, a storage unit might be the only way to hold on to both things of necessity and sentimental things.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And sometimes it is just sort of, I think, a delay tactic to sort of avoid having to be the ones who give up on something that you are very attached to. I guess I have the personal experience of having someone send it to me long distance, something that they have held on to for the last 50 years. And it is something that I know they cannot let go, so they would give it to somebody to dispose of it for them.
Right, right. So they don't have to do it themselves. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us. Really interesting conversation.
Thank you for having me. This is really great feedback from the listeners as well, too. I enjoy hearing their stories.
Great. Well, expect to see it showing up in your research. Nancy Wong is chair and a professor in the Consumer Science Department in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about the rise of self-storage facilities and what it might say about our consumer habits as a country. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there's a long-standing rivalry between Wisconsin and Minnesota, but which state's residents are faring better? We'll take a look at what the data shows, and we'll ask for your input as well.